So I said, what can I do to make the UN relevant for all? And I thought not about organizing a party because of the 75th anniversary, but a process.
So Dan and I have been observing the Summit of the Future process. We've sort of been running a couple roundtables, speaking to several different stakeholders. And one thing that we've observed around the Summit of the Future is we're sort of caught in the details a little bit. Wouldn't you say, Dan?
Yeah, we're looking at the nitty-gritty of policies and of procedures. And I think that's all really important. But, you know, sometimes when I'm listening to it, I feel as if we're creating disunity, where in fact, there's a lot of unity around the need for reform of the multilateral system.
Yeah, and we keep talking about building trust and having this moment of multilateral consensus and really revitalizing trust in the multilateral system. But look, I trust you, Dan, because I know you, not Dan Perel, UN representative of the Baha'i International Community or co-chair of Coalition for the UN We Need. But Dan, who is really good at making puns or likes to believe he's very good at making puns, and who I just get to know as a person. And that's where trust comes from. That's what we're trying to do with why we're here today, is build a window into the people behind some of these processes and help generate that moment of trust as we move forward into what is going to be a pretty busy year ahead. But let's backtrack a moment.
Let's backtrack to the part about where you said that I think I make good puns.
But let's go back a little bit further than that to the beginning of this process. What is our common agenda? What is the Summit of the Future? What's your take on all this, Dan?
So a couple of years ago at the 75th anniversary of the United Nations, the member states came together and wrote this political declaration, which has 12 commitments. And then the final paragraph of that declaration asked the Secretary General to produce a report that would talk about how those commitments can become a reality, at least through the UN system. That report, which he authored, was called Our Common Agenda. And in Our Common Agenda were a number of proposals, including three summits, one of which is the Summit of the Future. And that will take place in 2024. And it is towards that that this podcast is aiming. And the hope is to contribute a little bit of optimism in a space where increasingly we're seeing degrees of pessimism and negativity. We need to have this conversation. We need to be talking about the future of the global order. And yet we don't have to do it in a way that is predicting the end of times, but one that is saying this is an opportunity. And we would like our audience, you, the listener, to come away thinking this is something that's worth investing in. This is something that we hope future generations can look back on and say, thank you for making those efforts.
Yeah, a legacy we can be proud of as ancestors. As part of this, one of the things that we're going to be asking people who join us for our podcast is who they are, what brought them here, and what makes them tick. And we should set an example ourselves, Dan. So Dan, who are you, what brought you here, and what makes you tick?
The reason that I'm here is because humanity is at this crucial inflection point. And it's almost a trope now to say that. The world is at a stage where it needs to recognize that we are one human family on one shared planet. And we don't yet know what that looks like in terms of global policy and agreement and processes that are commensurate with the needs of humanity. But perhaps at a more personal level, I'm a father of two daughters, 5 and 8 years old. The 8-year-old was born in 2015, an auspicious year for the United Nations when the Sustainable Development Goals were adopted. And I do legitimately think every morning and evening about the world that she will inherit, about what the centenary of the UN looks like when she's 30. And I want to commit myself to making the world a better place, as cheesy as it sounds. The more of us who are on that train, I think the better off humanity will be. So Nudara, what brings you here?
I grew up in several different contexts. I grew up in the global south. I grew up in the global north. I saw privilege in some settings and I saw disadvantages in others. And I think that's very much shaped my perspective of the world. So I was always fascinated by the idea of the United Nations. And I remember coming on a school trip to the UN once, just sort of being gobsmacked and in awe of the whole thing. And like, oh, who are these people with their badges going through these banisters? These are the people that are making a difference, changing the world. I just remember sort of staring at them and being like, oh, I want to be like that one day.
That's the typical childhood dream. I think we all have
that
dream.
It is, don't you?
A diplomat at the UN with a blue badge. That's the pinnacle of human experience.
I mean, that's what I was as a kid. I was that person who just glared in awe. And then I did have that badge moment and realized that there were more flaws in the system than I had been aware of, and ended up jumping out of the UN to work on the reform process and connect civil society to that process and think about how do we work in the multilateral space? How do folks like the folks that you're going to hear about on this podcast think about the multilateral space? And keeping in mind that we're all working towards a summit of the future, we have less than 12 months to go. How do we make the most of this once in a generation moment? How do we optimize the summits of the future? For our first episode, we wanted to bring in someone who would help us set the stage, someone who really understands what's happening in this space, because they were one of the brains that helped kick it off. So Dan, who did we pick on for episode number one?
Yeah, so we brought in a dear friend, Maria Fernanda Espinosa. She currently serves as the executive director of Global Women Leaders, Voices for Change and Inclusion. While she was executive director, she also served as co-chair of the Coalition for the UN We Need. She is probably better known for her role as the president of the General Assembly. She was just the fourth female president of the General Assembly, which is sort of a shame. It would be great if there was a bit more equality in that regard. But it is nice that we have one quarter of the female presidents of the General Assembly on our first podcast. She has, since leaving that role, maintained her engagement very actively on a number of boards and executive committees all over the world on everything from nature to food to finance. You name the international debate, and she is somehow there contributing her thoughts, opinions, and wisdom. Prior to her role at the international level, she served as Ecuador's Minister of Foreign Affairs twice, Minister of National Defense, and Coordinating Minister of Natural and Cultural Heritage. She was also the first woman to become permanent representative of Ecuador to the United Nations in New York. That was back in 2008. She is very committed to these causes, very genuine, wise, thoughtful, and intuitive. She's got really an intuition about this that I think is lovely, as you'll hear in a moment. So let's turn over to the interview with Maria Fernanda Espinosa.
Hello, Maria. It is such a pleasure to have you here with us. You have been such a big part of this journey. You've been one of the people that really thought about the idea of UN reform very deeply. And Dan and I couldn't start this podcast series without welcoming you onto our show. Everyone knows you as Maria Fernanda Espinosa, 73rd PGA, the former defense minister, former foreign minister of Ecuador. But we want to know, who is the person behind the badge? Who is Maria Fernanda Espinosa? What got you here?
Who am I? I'm a woman, number one, a Latin American from Ecuador, and a feminist. I'm a person with different DNA origins, and I fully, fully embrace diversity, starting with myself.
What got you into this profession that now you are one of the key figures and faces of? What was your path as you got to where you are now?
Well, you know that very early in my career, my work was with and about indigenous peoples in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I was an environmentalist. In my training, I'm a linguist. I went to the Ecuadorian Amazon for the first time as a linguist to look at the bilingual, bicultural education experiences in Ecuador. And when I was there, coming from Quito, the capital of Ecuador, I discovered that there was, even for an Ecuadorian, a hidden secret of connectedness of communities living in extremely diverse environments. And very early, I got passionate about the relationship between culture and nature, societal organizations and nature. As a linguist, but also as a poet, I became fascinated by taxonomy. For example, in our Western languages, you have one word to say green.
Right.
I discovered that in some indigenous languages, you have 5 or 6 words to say green. Because for you, when you see a landscape, you see green. For them, the light green or the dark green, it's a huge difference because it means where you can do agriculture, the places that should remain untouched because sacred sites, spirituality connected to nature, etc. That completely transformed my urban, extremely westernized Cartesian French education that I had. That was a transformation completely for me. I was fascinated by this Amazonian world. I did a master's degree in Amazonian studies, and I quickly became connected to the global environmental movement. And one of my first jobs was in a very small NGO in Ecuador called Fundación Natura. And Fundación Natura was one of the first organizations around the world who did a Debt for Nature swap all the way at the beginning of the 90s. And that brought me back to the Amazon to work with indigenous communities, especially with indigenous women. Looking at the women in the Amazon, it's incredible because you can read in the literature things, but being in charge of the food security, being in charge of transmission of culture and knowledge, owning the land and being in control of the production of the community, of the education of children, of everything, even on power and decision making. You know, I can say proudly, I'm a feminist. I trust these women.
That's wonderful. It sounds like the Amazonian women had a tremendous impact on shaping the trajectory of your life.
It completely changed my life. I then went to work a step from the local community level to working for IUCN, the World Conservation Union, that brought me to Switzerland. I was the policy advisor on the indigenous people's rights for IUCN, then came back to Ecuador as regional director of IUCN, and then I decided to go into public life as foreign minister and in other jobs I had serving, you know, as a public servant. I think that's very much part of who I am today. And if you ask me about role models, I would say these women, the Shuar, the Siona, the Sequoia, the Quechua women of the Amazon, plus my mother, and if I have time, I will tell you about her, about who she was and how important she was. But also a person who took care of me since I was a little girl. She was called Matilde. She was illiterate. She didn't know how to read and write. Mm. And she was perhaps one of the wisest women I've ever known. She was a taxonomist. She was a cook. She was a psychologist. And she didn't know how to read and write. She spoke Quechua and Spanish, and she made us grow up, my brothers and I. All these things shape your life in a way. And when I worked for IUCN, and that was your question, Dan, I understood that it was very important to work at the community level to understand the national policy dynamics. But I discovered that the international world was important and this global norm setting issue was important. And I fought hard, for example, for the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I was in the drafting mode, supporting the drafters of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I was very much involved into that, following, supporting. But the pen holders were member states, but most women leaders from around the world.
It's fascinating. I love your, as I heard it, articulation of different forms of knowledge, this experiential knowledge, the fact that your nanny was illiterate and yet possessed of profound insights and understandings. That's brilliant. We have in the, quote, West, you know, to paint with too broad a brush, this understanding of education and knowledge is quite academic. It has to do with literacy and degrees. And then you say that the role model is the Quechua woman or your nanny who wouldn't necessarily tick those same boxes. And yet here you are, someone who has sort of taken that role of matriarch and in a sense brought it to the General Assembly for a time. You yourself, and I hope that those women back in Ecuador actually saw that in you and that you carried them with you in it. I don't know, Nudara.
Yeah, I feel like I've had the pleasure of knowing you, Maria, but every time I have a conversation with you, I feel like I discover so much more. And this was something, as someone who also, I feel, my first mentor and hero was my mother as well, that really touched me. But from the local to the global, this is something that we've been talking about so much recently. And that's really been testament to your journey. But as you said, you worked on many declarations in your time at the UN, including the UN 75 declaration, which kicked off quite a process that has manifested over the years. We don't want to talk about you as the PGA or you as any specific role that you took on, but rather what was going on in you, Maria Fernanda Espinosa's mind as this was taking place? What was the thinking? Was there a moment where you were like, this is going to be something, or this is what we're trying to do with it? What was going on in your head?
What was going through my mind on this UN 75 thing? During my presidency, I prepared a lot. I understood that it was extremely important to bring something to this international system that I knew from different spaces and places, and to give my little grain of salt into the process. And I'm very good for acronyms. And I said, oh, it's going to be the 75th year of the UN next year. The motto of my presidency was making the UN relevant for all. That was the phrase for my entire presidency. And I picked 7 priorities because I said 7 days a week, I will work for the UN, 7 priorities, 1 priority per day. And you know,
finish your presidency in a week.
You know, so I said, what can I do to make the UN relevant for all? And I thought not about organizing a party because of the 75th anniversary, but a process to engage youth, people in universities, in all places, in communities, to think and reflect on one question. What is the UN you would like to see for the next 75 years? What has worked? What hasn't worked? And this global movement of citizens, more than governments, to reflect about the UN and see how they mirror themselves in front of this huge, big organization where leaders meet in New York once a year, but something that is flesh and soul of the regular citizen. That was my idea.
I think we all want to see something like this come to pass, but it sounds like such a huge task. How would you go about making it a reality?
Easy to say, difficult to do, because then I said, how can we do that? Well, the idea of a global survey and et cetera. And then to say, well, let's do this track, but also the formal track. The formal track is member states owning the process and having a declaration. And believe me, at the beginning, it's not that I was very popular with my idea. The negotiation of the modalities resolution for the UN 75 process took us several months. It was difficult. And what I did to have more support and more traction among member states, I used the General Committee. People don't know that a General Committee exists, but the General Committee is the group of all the vice presidents of the General Assembly. So they are representation of all regions of vice presidents that people forget that they are there. But they are part of the governance of the UN General Assembly, and they are important because they represent all regions. So I said, okay, I'm going to use the General Committee plus the 5 members of the Security Council. It's a very powerful body. And I said, I'm going to bring the issue to them. So then it multiplies and then there is a mandate. And that's how the whole thing started. And I have also to thank the Secretary General because very quickly he said, I see myself pushing for that. But as I said, it's not that everybody said, oh, what a great idea since the very first second. No, it didn't happen that way. We had to build the traction, the political buy-in of member states. And as I said, several months just to agree on a modalities resolution. And now I'm very happy that it really unleashed a UN relevant for all moment with our common agenda, with the Summit of the Future, with a high-level advisory board on effective multilateralism, etc.
So there are many challenges the world is facing today.
We hear it at the beginning of all these speeches, and if you tune in, you may think that there's no hope. But we all know here at this little conversation that if there weren't hope, there wouldn't be these thousands of people here trying to make a difference. There's plenty of hope. We just have to figure out how to articulate it. But I often sit and wonder if overnight there could be one problem fixed. What do we think would be the key thing?
Poverty. I would even go a little further to say inequalities. Transactional inequalities, because poverty is a symptom of entrenched structural inequalities altogether. Mm-hmm. Because inequalities is not about inequality in the distribution of income and wealth. It is also an inequalities in power, inequalities and differences and gaps because you're a woman of color, because you are from the GLTBIQ plus community, because you have an X or Y faith. Since you asked for one, I know this is much more complex, but I would say inequalities.
So with that, we've discussed the past, we've discussed what you would do if you could wake up today in the present and change something. But we're thinking about the summits of the future. We're thinking about what happens next. It's not just about 2024, it's about what we do in 2024 to change everything that comes after that. And so a question to you, what to you is success when not just 2024, say 2045, the centenary of the United Nations? What is ideal? What should we have done by the summits of the future? What should we have done in the follow-up to that to really say, okay, this is a win now?
Well, I think that politics, including international politics, is the art of the possible, of course. But then it doesn't mean that you're not allowed to dream big at the same time. And of course, it's very important to read the current geopolitics so you're not seen as a naive person. You know, I think I have never seen such a polarization, such a fragmentation, such a lack of trust. This zero-sum game kind of diplomacy, etc., which is a true pity, and how you navigate that. But I would say, as I always say, the summit of the future should be seen as a process that would lead to something bigger. We have 1 year to go, and unfortunately, I think that by magic, the tensions and the conflicts we're experiencing today are not going to disappear. But at least, I would say, we need a pact for the future that would set the tone and framing of a profound retooling of the UN system. We pretty much know what the parts are going to be, but I'm perhaps more worried about the sum of the parts being at a higher level. And we speak about a new agenda for peace, a new digital compact, the declaration of future generations, et cetera, et cetera. And what is the umbrella on top of that? It has to be an umbrella that allows for process. So it's not a one-day summit and see you after that. No, it's the summit of the future being the beginning of a more profound structural process. And the key to all of this is to keep the political traction and energy to go all the way. And I think that if we are saying multilateralism 2.0, a UN for the 21st century, and all of the phrases that we already know, this is extremely important for the countries of the Global South, extremely important for the small island developing states, for the LMCs, the low and middle income countries, because they are the new actors of the organizational structure, because the charter was signed by 51 member states, you know, 51, and now we have 193. And all the additions to that are countries mostly after decolonization process and countries of the Global South. So this should not be seen as a Western agenda or a Northern agenda. Only it should be seen as the opportunity to rebalance power and agendas between the North and the South. And I think that there is a need to level the playing field in the organization. It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to make that happen and perhaps to unleash a serious process, to have a compass for something that is going to, at the end, become this multilateral system 2.0.
Or 3.0, if you count the League of Nations as...
Exactly, as exactly, if we count the League of Nations.
Yeah. So one question, as this is our first episode, hello, dear listener. One question that we plan to ask all of our guests, because the podcast is called UN Necessary.
Apologies. Because we love a pun and we couldn't help ourselves, or rather Dan couldn't help.
I was going to apologize, but, you know, that's maybe I shouldn't be an apologist for who I am.
No, this is who we are. Own it, Dan.
Exactly.
So the question we would like to ask all of our guests who are UN knowledge holders is, what is one thing that you think is really necessary that the UN does or can do? And what is one thing that is maybe unnecessary about what you see across the street these days?
Well, the list of things that the UN does and it should continue to do is long. I would start with the humanitarian work, with the work with refugees, situation of conflicts, deployment of the right infrastructure for people to survive situations of crisis. So kudos to the humanitarian people of the UN, vaccination around the world, et cetera, et cetera. Something that the UN should not be doing, it's hard to tell, because in the list of the things that the UN does, which are many, there is no one size fits all. In some countries, you might see that there is redundance, that the government alone and public sector together with the private sector and the society, they can take care of that. And the UN comes as this big policy guidance, capacity building mechanism, but they don't need to do things on the ground because it's taken care of. I have seen that. And so no need to have a huge deployment of staff at the ground level, et cetera, et cetera. But in some cases where countries have a big weakness in terms of their state capacity to respond to the fundamental needs of people, that's where the operational arms of the UN are needed. So it has to be tailor-made, the way the UN responds and operates, etc. It's very difficult to say, because I have seen all kinds of models. I have traveled in many places, especially when I was a president of the General Assembly. And in some parts, I have to be very frank, you don't quite see what is the UN doing here. No need to do this food security project here because it can be taken care of by X or Y. But in other cases, you see that the UN deployment on the ground can be a lifesaver. Mm. I think that not only for the UN, but for the world, I think that bureaucracies are extremely important. And bureaucracy is already a negative word by itself. You know, oh, the bureaucracy. But I really believe that not only for the UN, but in general for public service, we need creative and revolutionary bureaucracies that is going to improve the world altogether. And you see that most people working for the UN, as we say in Spanish, they wear the T-shirt big time. But it's not the general rule altogether. So to have responsible, creative, accountable bureaucracies in the UN and elsewhere, I think is going to make the world better. I am a little obsessed on quality, responsibility, and love of public service.
Maria, I think that comes through in everything that you say. It has been an absolute pleasure having this discussion with you. Dan and I have the privilege of being able to talk with you many a times, but I think this space has really allowed us to take off all our hats and just get to know you. And it's been a privilege and honor. Thank you for taking the time to join us. I don't know if, Dan, you have any final thoughts.
I was just thinking we got to know a little bit better the woman behind the WhatsApp.
For those of you who don't know, Maria is incredible at WhatsApp. She sends the best stickers that just lighten up my day. So thank you for taking the time, Maria.
Oh, I was so happy to have this conversation in a very candid, relaxed way. So thank you, Nodara. Thank you, Dan. And all the best in this podcast experience ahead of us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. My gosh, Dan, don't you love having a conversation with Maria Fernanda?
She's a delight.
It's been great. What are your takeaways from that discussion, Dan?
My favorite point is bringing the spirit of the grassroots indigenous woman to every space where we engage. Clearly, I am kind of none of those things in the typical eye of a listener. I'm not grassroots necessarily. I'm not indigenous, depending on how you understand that. And I am not a woman. Yet she is able to channel that spirit in her engagement at the UN. And I think I have a responsibility to do my best to channel that perspective as I'm speaking about these issues. Nudara, what do you come away with from that conversation?
What I really loved was this idea that the UN needs to tailor its work to different countries and that it is about people within these countries who all have different perspectives and different walks of lives. So how does that individual nature of the way that we operate in this world fit in with something like the Summit of the Future, a massive consensus building moment? And what we're looking for here is not a one size fits all solution, but rather getting everyone to collectively upgrade the tools that help us tailor the solutions just that little bit better. And I think that that for me was a real perspective she gave me, something that I'll hold into our discussions in future podcasts, but also in the work that we'll be engaging on in the year ahead. But what is our next podcast, Don? Dan, what? Sorry, Dan.
Are what's you doing the next? Another podcast with a guy named Don who I don't know about? So our next podcast will be looking at the past, present, and future. What are we doing? What is our arc of engagement? We'll be speaking with Ishan Shah, who is a young activist in these spaces who has more inside knowledge than I thought was possible, and also an amazing perspective on what the future should hold.
Tune in next time and we'll see you same time, same place.